All right, so Probable Cause, a deep dive. My name is Mike Boone. We are going to take a deep dive into Probable Cause tonight. For those of you that are watching us in the recording, we do have a lot of comments going on here that I'll be taking a look at the chat. We've got almost 200 folks here on the webinar. Fantastic. So if you see me kind of looking around or talking to the screen over here, that's what I'm doing. I'm chatting with folks that are on our webinar. A few things right off the bat here. Just a few disclaimers we're going to talk about here. Laws and standard operating procedures may be more restrictive. Most of the things we're going to talk about tonight are federal type things, constitutionally based, but you guys know your agencies. You know that you can be more restrictive, pay attention to your policies, and abide by that. If you have any doubts, push it up the chain. That's what your sergeants, lieutenants, corporals, captains, you name it, that's what they get paid the big bucks for. So if you have questions, reach out to them, push it up the line for them. And lastly, this course is legal education, not legal advice. We're here to talk about making you guys make better decisions out there, give you some good advice, educate yourselves so you're making good decisions out there. So here's our agenda. We're going to talk about probable cause in general. It's something we deal with all the time, but we're going to try to break it down, talk about what defines it, training and experience, what we can use to speak about that in our arrest reports and determining probable cause. Reasonable suspicion, we'll touch on just a little bit. Factual justification continuum, we'll talk about what that means. Sources of information, how the heck do we even get to probable cause? Source credibility, and we'll talk about something called the informer's privilege to wrap things up here at the end of our show. So, yeah, thanks, Rick. Rick has confidence in me. We'll get this thing sorted out. I think we're rolling now. All right, so let's talk about what probable cause in general is. Now, this is one of those things, is a baseline where we got to make that determination. Can we formally arrest a person or not? And probable cause, when we look at it from the courts, is never just enough to justify a non-consensual search or seizure. We need probable cause plus. We talk about that a lot in our teaching at Blue to Gold here. He's like, PC plus, what do we have here? You can have probable cause, but does probable cause alone get you inside of somebody's home? Well, no. You got to have some sort of exigency or some sort of emergency aid. Shane throwing out the next slide. Crew. We talk about crew all the time here, but PC alone just it doesn't get you there. You've got to have something else here, or like you said, a warrant or an exception to the warrant rule, or yeah, Shane. Look what Rick said, huh? Or like you said, Shane, you know it, you love it, and that's what we teach all the time. Do you have crew? Do you have consent by a person that can give it? Someone that has apparent authority, actual authority, has standing over something that can give us consent. Do you have a recognized exception to go into that home? Is it based on emergency aid, or is there some sort of evidence that we are, worried about destruction of? There's another articulable factor, recognized exception. Or lastly, do we have a warrant? Okay, do we have an arrest warrant? A search warrant that allows us to go inside that house. And for those of you that are new here, all of our teaching revolves around this concept of crew. Every search and seizure requires having crew. So we want you to ask yourself, do you have crew? Do I have a crew to go inside this person's home or search this person's car? There's no exceptions. But what I don't want from you all is this. Can't really explain why. Okay, that doesn't work. You guys know that doesn't work. I can't explain why. Well, that's just how we've always done business. That's how we do things. No. Okay. That's not going to work. Okay. You can't really explain why. You got to show the courts why you did what you did and be reasonable about it. That all comes from the Fourth Amendment. So here is a definition that gets used quite a bit when we come to probable cause. So probable cause is a flexible, common sense standard, common sense. Hopefully, all have it. Merely requiring that the facts available to the officer would warrant a man of reasonable caution to believe that certain items may be contraband or stolen property or useful as evidence of a crime. It does not demand any showing that such a belief be correct or more likely true than false. And we'll talk about this idea of more likely true than false a little bit later on when it comes to preponderance of evidence. We're talking about probable cause in this. And from Illinois versus Gates, which is a real famous United States Supreme Court case that touches on this probable cause idea here, and we'll talk about this case a little bit more towards the end of the webinar. But perhaps the central teaching of our decisions bearing on the probable cause standard is that a practical, non-technical conception, as the very name implies, we deal with probabilities. And as you guys know, we have recently changed our third golden rule here at Blue to Gold to talking about dealing with probabilities as opposed to possibilities. And we all know, as police officers, we love possibilities, right? Man, anything's possible, right? There's possible there's a kilo of cocaine in that car. It's possible he has a gun. But where's the probabilities? And that's, what we're talking about here when probable cause. And it's not technical, but factual and practical considerations of everyday life on which reasonable and prudent men, not legal technicians, act. So, who are they talking about out there? Who are they talking about, these reasonable and prudent men? Who are they talking about out there, folks? Versus these legal technicians. Who's that? You shut everybody down there, Rick. So these legal technicians, they're talking about who? The lawyers out there, right? The lawyers that have the ability to kind of just hang out and, sit back and make a decision, focused on strictly the law. But these persons that we talk about, these prudent, reasonable, prudent men, well, that's us. That's the law enforcement community out there that's out there doing the job, applying these laws out there and making these decisions at 2 o'clock in the morning, with just you and your buddy from the academy. Sufficient probability, not certainty. Okay, that's what we're talking about with probable cause. Is there a fair probability that this took place? It's the touchstone of reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment. And again, this is, foundational. We talk about the Fourth Amendment here. What's reasonable? Are our actions reasonable? And we're just looking for a fair probability when it comes to probable cause. So how do we define it? All right, there's a few different things, and this one pretty much captures what we're talking about when it comes to probable cause. So facts and circumstances drawn from a reasonably trustworthy source, and we'll talk about that a little later on. Who are these trustworthy sources that we can draw this information from that would cause a reasonable person, a reasonable person, and this is going to be us, the police officers out there, right? These police officers are drawing this conclusion to believe that a particular individual, you got to draw the nexus that this person has committed this crime, this particular crime, utilizing, the elements. We're meeting these elements of that crime and showing that you are the person that we believe did it based on these facts and circumstances. That's a pretty general definition of probable cause, and that's probable cause to arrest. Now we're going to look at probable cause to search. Same thing. Facts and circumstances drawn from a reasonably trustworthy source that would cause a reasonable person to believe evidence of a crime is located in a particular location. A search warrant for a home. Why is there a fair probability that there's evidence of that crime inside that house? So there's your kind of your comparison between search and arrest definitions for probable cause. And so what if our belief is later disproven? Are we on the hook for that? Are we in trouble for that? And the idea behind this question is really many situations confront officers in the course of executing their duties are more or less ambiguous. So the courts are saying, giving this, there must be room allowed for some mistakes on their part. Is the expectation for us to be perfect out there? Unfairly, maybe it is a little high, but the courts are reasonable in what we're doing out there. There's a leeway for mistakes on our part. There's, the probability. But the mistakes must be those of reasonableness. Reasonable men and women acting on facts leading to sensibly to their conclusions of probability. Now, that's the baseline again. We're not perfect, okay? And I've definitely made my fair share of mistakes in my career, but it's got to be, on some sensibly based on some reasonableness out there and coming to that determination of probability out there. And this comes from a case called Illinois versus Wardlow, which is a reasonable suspicion case talking about unprovoked flight, but it kicks it back and it talks to about Terry in here. And you think about Terry versus Ohio, we had the ability, back in the 60s, we could either stop a person based on consent or we had probable cause. And this was the development of reasonable suspicion. So in Terry, they talked about, they accepts the risk that officers may stop innocent people. And that happens. But the Fourth Amendment accepts that risk in connection with more drastic police action. So, we're talking about persons arrested and detained on probable cause to believe they have committed a crime may turn out to be innocent. But what facts did we know at the time? What consideration did we develop to, say that there's a fair probability that this person is involved in a crime? And these are the information that I can show that that person is the one who did it. And that's they understand that leeway that there possibly or probably could be some mistakes out there. And a little pro tip from us, it's very important to recognize that, as the name implies, probable cause leaves room for mistaken conclusions. But again, they've got to be reasonable. Okay, we can't just be, wild carding stuff and making accusations that are completely unfounded. It's got to be reasonable. And if what we knew at the time and we're doing our due diligence there and the information we gathered, turned out to be mistaken at the time, well, was it reasonable that we believed it at the time? So it's by its very nature, probable cause includes a margin for error. Okay, it's not expected to be perfect. And luckily for us, the courts are never expecting that perfect. We'll talk, about beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that absolute certainty? No, it's not. So there is that margin for error in what we do. Just because the search does not lead to the discovery of the item sought does not mean the search was illegal. So let's say you have you've got probable cause and you talk with the judge or the magistrate. Let me ask you all, if we don't find what we're looking for, let's say it's a narcotic search warrant, and the judge signs off for it, we serve the warrant, and during our search, we don't find any narcotics. Is that bad? Is that a bad warrant? What do y'all think? Got a no, nope. Love it, right? No. It's going to be based on the facts we knew at the time. Was there a fair probability that this is in there? And yeah, Ashley, embarrassing, but no, right? You never want to have the bone sitting on your desk the next day, right? When you hit a warrant and get nothing, right? Now, I always measured if a warrant was good or not when I was in narcotics, is if you hit at the house and there's a Scarface poster on the wall, you knew you were in the right place. Okay. You know there's dope somewhere. Anybody disagree with that? Because I think it's 100% certainty that there's Scarface poster on the wall if there is dope in the house for sure. So just because an arrestee, and also just because an arrestee is ultimately released or acquitted, doesn't mean the arrest was illegal. Like, the defense for an unlawful arrest is probable cause. Okay. What did you know at the time? Now, later on, when it gets litigated and goes to courts, that's a whole different thing because, if they're released or acquitted, that's for the courts to decide. What did we know at the time in developing our probable cause? So, in this case here, this is kind of a very interesting case here. This Hill versus California. A robbery takes place. They gather, there's a few people involved, and they determine this other guy, Hill, is involved, and they figure out where he lives. They've got a description of this guy, and they've got probable cause to arrest him for this robbery. So they go to his house, and when they get there, they run into this guy, Miller, and they believed it to be Hill, and they didn't think that this guy, Miller, was telling the truth. They thought it was this guy, Hill. So they arrest him for this robbery. And it's interesting, the courts say here, the officers in good faith believed Miller was Hill and arrested him for the robbery. They were quite wrong, as it turned out. Okay, it was not the guy they had probable cause for. And subjective good faith belief would not in itself justify either the arrest or the subsequent search. But on the record before us, the officer's mistake was understandable, and the arrest a reasonable response to the situation facing them at the time. Some of the factors they looked at is, well, it was his house, and he was walking out of the house when they were going there. He matched the description. I think when he didn't have the proper identification with him at the time here. That's what the courts are looking for, that it was an understandable justification as to why they believe this was the person they were looking for. So what if we were mistaken, though? What if we were mistaken as to one or more of the facts we considered? Is that a done deal? If we were mistaken about something. Nope. All right, there we go. All right. So yeah, so we got a couple of different things that the courts talk about: mistakes of fact and a mistake of law. Yeah, like Zach said, he's talking about this good faith concept here. Is, was it f mistake of fact or law? And so let's talk about these mistakes of fact. So an officer's reasonable mistake of fact can provide probable cause for a stop. So in this case here, out of DC, the officer's driving by and they see Williams driving by, and he thinks that he's not wearing his seatbelt. But based on his ability and where he's at looking at him, he believes that there's no seatbelt on. So he makes the stop. That's a violation of the statute for not wearing a seatbelt. He makes the stop based on that, approaches the vehicle, and the seatbelt's on. And it doesn't appear that he necessarily was, they'll put it on as the cop walks up, being all casual about it, sliding that thing on. And ultimately, he develops more information and makes an arrest for some narcotics here. And the court said here, because the officer's belief that the seatbelt was unbuckled was reasonable based on his vantage point and the way he articulated it, whether or not it was erroneous, he had the probable cause necessary to conduct the stop. So the court said, okay, although you were wrong, this mistake of fact and believing what you saw, it didn't take away or negate the probable cause that he believed he had at the time. So they go on to say, even if an officer is mistaken about a relevant fact, that mistaken belief may still be counted favorably towards the probable cause determination, so as long as the mistaken belief was reasonable. And there it is again. We can't, you can't clearly in our job, like, oh, well, let's just say that the guy doesn't have a seatbelt, pull him over. We know that's wrong, and that's not the expectation of what we do out there. So you just got to show the courts that why your mistake of fact was indeed reasonable. I was driving by as we passed each other. I looked over, I saw, and it appeared that there was no seatbelt on them at the time. Then I made the stop. So they're just looking for that reasonableness versus mistake of law. Now, this is a little bit different concept here, but when we look at this Hine versus North Carolina case, the trooper was behind this vehicle, and when the vehicle slowed down for a little bit there, they saw that the left brake light was out. And the officer was like, well, you know what? You've got to have, believing that you've got to have three operable brake lights or two operable brake lights at the time, the officer conducted a stop based on the taillight, the inoperable taillight. Ends up making contact with the driver. This guy, Hine, is in the back seat, kind of laying down, being all evasive to a certain degree. But the driver says, hey, you know what? They agreed to a consent to search the vehicle. They find some cocaine in there, and they end up charging Hine. Well, he's like, well, hang on a second here. The law, it's kind of interesting case because the law at the time was a little bit ambiguous as to what the requirement was for the brake lights, and they cleared it up a little bit that that essentially the officer was mistaken about the law at the time, mistaken about the statute in doing so. So they said, the question here is whether reasonable suspicion or probable cause can rest on a mistaken understanding of the scope of a legal prohibition. We hold that it can. So even though the officer, was mistaken and ultimately found out that he was mistaken about it, it still was reasonable because the law was a little bit muddy at the time, and it's been since clarified. But, when we look at this, we've all said it here. We stop somebody, and the citizen's like, "Well, I didn't know." What do we say to them? I didn't know I couldn't do that. What's our response as cops when someone says, I didn't know about that law? And we're like, oh, okay, let me tell you about it. And then you get a free pass today. Is that how that works? Yeah. Turtle says, yeah, sounds like a Ren stop. Yeah, that's a little bit more pretextual here, but yeah, Amanda, right? Ignorance of the law is not a defense. And that works for us too. So, officer's mistaken belief as to what the law actually is can be included in the probable cause formulation as long as it was reasonable. But the government cannot defend an officer's mistaken legal interpretation on the ground the officer was unaware of or untrained in the law. Well, we've got to know how to do our job, right? We've got to know what our laws are, what our statutes are, what our city ordinances, county ordinances, you name it. There's an expectation of that. That's why we spend so much fun time in the academy and continuing education and paying attention to legal updates out there. That's important because you can't say, I didn't know. Okay, it doesn't work like that. But in this case here, it was a misinterpretation of the law in the officer's mind. And the court said, well, that can be relied on as probable cause. And it means that an officer's reliance on an incorrect memo or training program from the police department makes no difference in the analysis. So again, they said basically on the back end of this here that the stop was going to be allowable based on this mistake of understanding of the law, but it's still got to be reasonable. And these are rare circumstances, okay? It's rare because, the expectation for the court is, like I said, we know our job. We know what we're doing. We know what we're supposed to be doing this. So it's not going to happen real often where it's going to be excusable. A lot of times when we've got new legislative updates out there, new laws on the books, we got to pay attention to that kind of stuff. And hopefully your all's agencies are out there kind of getting ahead of the game. Hey, effective October 1st of this year, such and such and such is no longer illegal anymore, or this has changed in our statute. And so then when midnight hits, cops are aware of the changes in our law. But we do have that obligation, like it says here at the bottom, to be well versed in the law they're tasked with enforcing. Everybody remembers how much they loved criminal law in the academy, right? Those hours and hours and hours of going over the statutes and the elements of the crime and everything that comes with it, right? One of our favorite classes. Sure, huh? I'm sure Amanda, you loved it. All right. So, is the probable cause standard subjective or objective? What do you guys think? Jordan Spieth, like the pro golfer? Right. We'll talk about Jack. We'll talk about training and experience a little bit later. All right. So here we go. The courts are looking for us to be, subjectively, we have a lot of stuff going on here, but the eyes of the courts, when we look at, the standard that is showing here, we've got to be objective in what we're showing here. So good faith on the part of the arresting officers is not enough, right? Can we go to before the court and just say, Your Honor, my heart was in it, therefore it's a good arrest. My heart was in it, so I felt like I could just go inside the home. It doesn't work that way. We know that. So if subjective good faith alone were the test, and this is pretty interesting, the protections of the Fourth Amendment would evaporate. Now think about that. If subjective alone was good enough, if we just thought in our minds, all right, I've got probable cause, unfounded in any objectivity, evidence, fact gathering, that kind of stuff, the Fourth Amendment would evaporate. That's a pretty powerful statement when you think about it. And the people would be secure in their persons, houses, and papers and effects only in the discretion of the police. Pretty powerful statement in there, right? So yeah, we've got to show some objectivity in this. Okay, objectivity. What we think is gets us to where we want to go, and that's how we become good cops out there. But it leads us to becoming the ability to articulate and objectively show these findings of probable cause. In a case out of the Eighth Circuit. Whether probable cause exists is an objective question of law. An officer's subjective belief is irrelevant to whether his affidavit included sufficient facts to establish probable cause. And, we'll talk about, can you put your opinions in your police reports? And the answer is yes, but you've got to back it up with articulable facts, circumstances, and articulation as to why you believe something objectively. Bottom line is what the courts are looking for. Right, Sean, yeah, right. The Minority Report for sure, right? How to predictive of future events for sure. All right, in this case here, the policeman testified. And this is kind of interesting because it kind of cuts both ways when you talk about this here, where we've got this objective standard here, but in this kind of goes the, it's going the other direction. The policeman testified that he did not have probable cause to search, and at best was merely suspicious. So we've got, a hunch, maybe reasonable suspicion, but do we get to conduct searches? Well, searches of vehicles or homes or anything based on reasonable suspicion? The answer is no. Of course, we would not consider ourselves bound by a police officer's inability to articulate his conclusions if the facts clearly demonstrated the existence of probable cause. So although the officer in this didn't feel like he had probable cause to do so, the court's analysis on the back end of this said, well, you know what? I think you did, based on the articulation and things that went forward on that. Kind of interesting. Since the existence of probable cause involves a legal question, the courts are going to make this analysis here. The court will make that ultimate decision as to whether probable cause existed. And again, that's a lot of our determination when we talk about, our preliminary hearings and, the judge finding that probable cause exists to, carry the case over further into trial. And like I said before, cutting both ways, the officer's belief in this as to the existence of probable cause is not relevant here. The courts found that probable cause existed, and that's our minimum burden for the making that arrest. Kind of interesting when you look at the flip side of that here. Now that was all testimonial, and then I'm sure it's kind of interesting how the report was written. But objectively looking at it, that's what we have to show the courts. We talked about training experience a little bit earlier on here. Now, do we as officers get to rely on our training and experience to help us develop probable cause? What do you think? Based on my training experience. That's one of our favorite things to say, right? I always say when I was teaching at the academy, you make an arrest on day one, and that defense attorney puts you on the stand. It's like, so based on my training experience, you say, officer, all right, what kind of experience do you have? Well, 3 hours on the job, right? Yeah, Sean, yes, but you have to be able to back it up. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Where do you gain training and experience? You gather a baseline in the academy about some training, but then you start to, freedom, training, 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 right? Freedom says, yeah, you gain that experience, and you get to rely on your experience when you start to move forward in your careers. So in Terry, which is, again, is a case based on reasonable suspicion, in determining whether the officer acted reasonably in such circumstances, due weight must be given to the specific reasonable inferences which he is entitled to draw from the facts in light of his experience. And when we talk about Terry, when we look at this, Detective McFadden had been working downtown Cleveland for 30 some odd years. I think it was like 38 years by the time he retired. And his forte, if you will, was pickpocketing going on down there in Cleveland. And he definitely, drew on his experiences as an investigator, and relying on these prior arrests that he made when he was stood there that Halloween day downtown Cleveland and watched Terry walk back and forth and meet up with the two guys that he was with there, and meeting up, walking back and forth here. He was able to explain why he believed that, he thought a robbery was going to take place, and he didn't have to wait for that to actually take place. So that experience becomes a factor in our articulation here. This one out of Illinois here. What constitutes probable cause for search and seizures must be determined from the standpoint of the officer. Okay, they're relying on what we know with his skill and knowledge. Okay, the skill and knowledge that we develop throughout our careers, rather from the standpoint of an average citizen under similar circumstances. And we all know we see dead people, right? We see dead people as officers. We go out there and we see things that your average citizen doesn't. We pay attention to things. Why is that guy standing there? Or this person that walks into the restaurant. We're looking at things that from our experience and skill and knowledge, well, we pay attention to things differently, and that's the basis of what these courts are looking for. They're looking for our knowledge and our training experience to again, objectively explain why we came to these conclusions. And from the great Wayne LaFave and his treatises here, the probable cause determination must ultimately be made by a judicial officer who is not an expert in matters of law enforcement. So that, ultimately, probable cause is determined by who? The judge, the courts, right? The magistrates in there, but they're not an expert in matters of law enforcement. Okay, they're not out there doing the job. They're not out there in the streets with us. They're not out there making these split-second decisions. So consequently, it is incumbent on the officer to explain the nature of his expertise or experience and how it bears upon the facts which prompted the officer to arrest or search. Let me ask you all this. Can we tell a judge what to think? Can we tell a judge, "Judge, I want you to think this. I came to this conclusion. I want you to think the same thing." Just like that. And the answer is going to be no. Right? No, the answer is no. We have to explain. We have to articulate our, why we searched the car, why we made an entry into that home. Sean says, "I would advise not to, right? Your Honor, just follow along, right?" Exactly. We've got to explain them. And then, so hopefully, when we articulate and explain the nature of what we did, then the judge will agree with us. That's what we're looking for. But we just can't tell them. We can't give these conclusions that there's drugs in that house, Your Honor. Sign my warrant. Is the judge going to sign off on that? No. We've got to articulate why. Why we have, there's a fair probability that drugs are in that house, and then they agree with us. So these conclusory statements is what we're talking about here, is how the observed conduct and its nexus to the criminality is consistent with the officer's training and or experience. We see things that, like I said, other people don't see. To the a regular citizen out there, seeing two people handshake in 7-Eleven at 2 o'clock in the morning, they're not just saying hi to each other in our eyes. That's what? That's a hand to hand. Okay. But your average everyday citizen might just think it's a pleasant greeting. So these comments standing alone are completely unhelpful. We've got to show why. Why we came to this conclusion. Why at 2 o'clock in the morning, when two people walk up to each other and shake hands briefly, and there appears to be exchange of money and an object, why we came to this conclusion that it's a hand to hand. I like that. Peter says, yeah, show your work, right? Your teacher always want you to show your work. That's exactly what we're talking about here. Show your work when we do your stuff out there. Definitely so. I like it. So when we look at the balance of, either searching somebody or seizing someone, well, the quantum of evidence needed to constitute probable cause is the same. All right. It's the same to probable cause to arrest a person or probable cause to get a search warrant for a home. It's the same. Okay. It's the same burden that we're looking for. Now, some things might take more facts, more pieces of evidence to develop our probable cause to get that search warrant for the home, but essentially it's the same thing. So the probable cause standard, not higher for an arrest as compared to a search or vice versa. You just have to meet that burden of a fair probability. Like I said, some things you might need more on. If you've taken our strive for our bulletproof report writing classes out there, we talk about striving for five out there. Articulate five things. The more facts, the more circumstances you can put into something, the more reasonable you're going to be viewed, and the more likely that judge is going to agree with you on the back end. So, we're mainly talking about probable cause here tonight, but let's just touch on reasonable suspicion a little bit, because they're intertwined for sure. It's just kind of what you get to do is a little bit different between the two here. So when we look at reasonable suspicion, I kind of like this idea here. It's like probable cause light. Okay, it's like little probable cause, but it's lesser. Okay, it's just a lesser form of probable cause because you need a lesser justification. Okay, is there a moderate chance of what's taking place either now, in the future, or in the past? Is there a moderate chance of this criminal activity taking place, which again is a lesser burden than probable cause? and it can rely on less reliable information, and it permits lesser intrusions. With reasonable suspicion, we get to do our investigative detentions. We get to do pat downs on a person if we can articulate, armed and dangerous factors in there. That's kind of our burden of doing this. So just kind of think of this reasonable suspicion as probable cause light. So picture it like this, right? Probable cause, Budweiser. Reasonable suspicion, Bud Light. All right. Or if that doesn't work for you guys here, you've got probable cause and reasonable suspicion. All right. Probable cause light. It's just a smaller, littler version of probable cause. Okay. There you go. Thanks, Sean. I appreciate the LOL on that one for sure. It's just a smaller version of that in doing so. And reasonable suspicion is effectively is probable cause, but like we said, in this lighter version of it to briefly detain. When we develop probable cause, we get to do what? We get to, make a lawful custodial arrest of a person and take them to jail. Here, this allows us to detain a person for investigative purposes to confirm or dispel our suspicions of what's going on. Or in the case, can we frisk this person, based on that? But probable cause to conduct a limited search for weapons. That's the what we're looking for here. So it's kind of, you don't really hear it discussed this way too much. That's why we kind of have these two different wording here, reasonable suspicion and probable cause. So we use this because, Terry kind of gave us that reasonable suspicion idea, is that we use the term reasonable suspicion to distinguish between the two levels of probable cause. Okay, probable cause light, which is our reasonable suspicion to kind of help, unmuddy the waters a little bit. Reasonable suspicion as compared to probable cause can be based upon, again, a lesser quantity of information. Okay, it's a much smaller burden for us to articulate and explain why we're doing information that is, less reliable. Now, we've got to have something. We know we can't just, stop people based on hunches. We've got to have, some facts, some circumstances that there's, a crime, a moderate chance of some criminal activity taking place. And, the information is less specific. I mean, it's a more generalized idea of what's going on. So that's just kind of a little touch on some reasonable suspicion there. So we've been kind of talking about these different burdens, legal justification burdens that we have to do as police officers. And, I'm going to show you a factual justification continuum here in a little bit here. Just kind of lay it out to show, visually what it looks like here. And so this word continuum is interesting. If Zach Miller, if you're here, say hey, Zach. But he's got, I think, a little more experience with this word here and talking about, it's a unique word in the English language because it has that W capacity. And can anybody else think of another W word in the English language that we use out there? This isn't the trivia question. Man, Brent, spot on. Vacuum, right? For sure. All right, there's vacuum. And I think Zach tells the story the best that he was teaching a class somewhere, and he's like, well, someone's like, well, hang on a second here. There's another one out there that that we use, and it is a moo moo. Who knows what a moo moo is out there? Sean, I think that's wait, moo moo moo. There you go. Yeah, Sean's got it. Moo moo, right? And I guess, technically speaking, well, first of all, who are the folks in the picture here? Do we know? Yeah, dress, huh? Rick, back off my girl, huh? Good old boss hog, right? So technically this word comes from, yeah, there you go. There you go. Oh my gosh, Ashley. They're not here watching, are they? So technically, mumu comes from the Polynesian descent, and it's got the apostrophes in there to break up the U's. So there you go, moo, mumu, Polynesian there. All right, back to business here. So when we look at this factual justification, and Ashley, I won't say anything to your parents about that one. All right, so our factual justification continuum, these legal burdens we have to come up with here. So if we look at it on kind of a timeline scale or a linear scale here, you've got 0 to 100%. And I never taught it like this when I was in the academy, but I've seen it, and you won't really, I've heard people talk about putting percentages to some of our factual justifications and doing so. So this is kind of a generalized conceptual idea of how to think of some of these things. So if we look at it here, we've got the old beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, is that beyond all doubt? Is that absolute certainty? What do you guys think? Miranda says no. So when we look at beyond a reasonable doubt, right? That's what we need to get our criminal convictions out there, right? We've got to put it to where, it's not beyond all doubt, but beyond reasonable doubt. And if you're going to put a percentage to it, I'd say it's really up there, 97, 98%, somewhere in there. But it's definitely up there. And then you've got clear and convincing evidence. And you see this a lot in, civil type cases, maybe child custody or some sort of alimony type things in there. And when you look at this, it's kind of more in that 70 to 80% range if you were wanting to put some numbers to it. Then we've got the old preponderance of evidence. And when you look at this, by the numbers, it's more likely than not. There you go, Arturo, right? More certain than not. It's more likely that this took place than not. So, you look at that one, it's just tipping the scale a little bit. That's in that 51%, if you will. And we see this a lot when we get sued, right? Our civil trials out there and that preponderance of evidence burden they have to meet, when they're looking for some money from us in there. And then, like we've been talking about tonight, probable cause, right? That is, when you look at that, is it, more certain than not? Well, not always. Sometimes it is. Is it 50-50? Not that either. It's just one of those where, like we've been kind of making that determination in, probable causes, there's that fair probability based on what we know that this crime took place and they're the one that did it. And then as we slide down that scale further down, reasonable suspicion. That's kind of way down there. I don't know if you can put numbers to it, 30 some odd percent, something like that. But these are just kind of conceptual numbers. Again, I don't really teach it like that. I think the understanding of these different legal burdens is a much better way to look at it. So, probable cause, from this case out of the District of Columbia says probable cause requires more than bare suspicion. Okay, bare suspicion alone, reasonable suspicion. It up that scale, it requires more, but it's less than a preponderance of evidence. Kind of like our scale that we said is more likely than not. So the level of suspicion needed to satisfy the reasonable suspicion standard is considerably less than a proof of wrongdoing by preponderance of evidence. So again, that's just the courts kind of filling in that scale, saying preponderance of evidence is here, probable cause is here. Reasonable suspicion down there. And if you want to throw it way down the line, throw a hunch in there. And we know we can't take anything, we can't take legal action on hunches, but it points us the right direction, that's for sure. So at our lowest level of probable cause, it does not have to be that more likely than not. Okay. It's just showing that, is there a fair probability? But in other cases, probable cause would require the showing of more likely than not. So we'll clean this up a little bit. Here's a couple of examples. So we'll talk about this here. So three men commit an armed robbery, which resulted in a shooting death of one of the victims. Only one of the robbers displayed and used that firearm. The police obtained a search warrant. So these guys, we figure out who they are, and we don't recover the gun, but we figure out that they three different suspects live in three different locations, and so we've developed our probable cause. And we're getting search warrants for each one of these places. We obtain search warrants, search one of these residents for the one firearm. So if we're looking at our percentages in here, well, where's our math majors out there? We've got three homes, one gun. Statistically, what are the chances, percentage-wise, of where the gun is? Do. Man, Jordan, love it. All right, you're a hell of a golfer too. All right, yeah, 33 and a third, right? There's a 33% chance that that gun is in one of these three homes because there's one gun, three places that we're looking at. So there's way less than a 50% probability that that gun is in this particular residence. So that, but it would still be reasonable, right? It would still be a reasonable search warrant because you've got probable cause, even though you've only got 33 and a third chance of it being in there. It's just based on that probable cause determination. Versus this, you're standing outside a vehicle, not on curtilage. A police officer observes several white pills inside the vehicle. Without closer examination, it's impossible to tell by visual observation alone whether the pills are illegal drugs or aspirin or other lawful to possess substance. So we don't know. Okay, we see some pills in there, but we can't say for sure if this is illegal or not. So at best, it's 50-50. All right? It's equivocal whether the pills are illegal or not. Would the officer need some additional evidence to suggest the pills were illegal drugs in order to seize them? What do you think? We stand outside there like, I don't know. Maybe it's drugs. Maybe it's not. What do we need? We need more. Yeah, we got a lot of yeses coming in, right? Yeah, so we're going to need more on this one. So, here we're talking about 50-50 and it's not a good search. Before we talked about, 33 and a third. When we look at percentage wise here, you're going to need more in this case for us to be able to, use the Carroll doctrine in there and the search that vehicle based on probable cause. All right, so how the heck do we get probable cause? Where do our sources of information out there? How do we get this out, these pieces of information? So we talk about rules of evidence a lot. There's federal and state rules. And for the most part across the United States here, they're similar in what we can get introduced into a court setting, but that govern the admissibility of evidence in a criminal trial. And each jurisdiction has their own. But the rules of evidence, however, typically have little bearing on whether an officer may consider the evidence of probable cause or reasonable suspicion. So we don't operate out there as police officers thinking, oh man, is this going to be admissible in court? What are the rules of evidence again? I know last time the DA said that they couldn't enter that in. That's not what we're looking for out there. We are making that determination for probable cause out there in the field. And it's, later on that this evidence to be introduced or not. And again, we got to gather our evidence lawfully. We don't need to violate the Fourth Amendment. We got to use crew, all those type of things. But, the rules of evidence shouldn't be a part of what we are, our determination out there. But there are some things out there that we use to determine probable cause that are not going to be admissible in court. First of all, what movie is this? Who are we meeting in this movie? Whoa, watch the language, everybody. Dang. This is a family-friendly show. All right. Yeah, Meet the Fockers here, right? And we're doing the polygraph examination here. Can we use a polygraph to help determine probable cause in making our arrest? Willie says, is he in the circle? Yeah, are you in the circle of trust or not, right? So yes, okay, we can use these polygraphs. And again, it's gonna depend on the level of professionalism there and the level of certainty that comes with this and was it done correctly. But as a matter of federal law, polygraph results are one of many factors that we can use to determine from the objective, again, objective viewpoint, probable cause for an arrest existed under the Fourth Amendment. We can use it that, but most of the time, it's not going to be admissible under the rules of evidence. Okay, so just one of those things here. What about this live lineup? And anybody out there, has anyone ever got the chance to do an actual live lineup? I wanted to my whole dang career, and we had a place at the jail where we could do it, but that's where we stored junk. Anyone out there ever got the opportunity to actually use a real live lineup, like walk in, turn left? Turn right of that. Kevin says, yeah. Nice. Mark, yes. Okay, good. So it is kind of alive and well out there, some of you out there. What do you think about this one? If this is your actual live lineup, do we have a problem with it? And again, to include the guy holding the sign, do we have a problem with this live lineup? Kevin said 40 years ago. Man, Kevin, you're hardcore. Yeah, Zach says, is that a little prejudicial if you line up everybody out there and the guy is holding this suspect sign in his hand? And that's kind of the idea of this case a little bit here. It's not so blatant, but they end up showing the person. There he goes. Kevin says, you don't want it to be unduly suggestive. And, if we're doing photo lineups or any kind of live lineups, hopefully you all have procedures in place that create that fair environment. We're not being unduly suggestive in doing so. And this clearly would be a little bit suggestive here. Hold this sign for me, buddy. All right. So we conclude that the identification procedures employed here, although highly improper, were not so flawed that they could not contribute to finding a probable cause. Again, they, don't put them in the jail uniform for sure. Everybody else is in civilian clothes for sure. In this case, again, they just showed a single person, a picture to a person. And again, they found it wasn't flawed enough to get rid of that finding a probable cause. So, you look at these, unduly suggestive lineups. We want to stay away from that. What about, the old the PB tests, right? PBT field tests out there, that preliminary breath tests out there. So we use them out there to determine, help us determine probable cause, and it can be admitted as substantive evidence. However, it lacks sufficient reliability, excuse me, but we can use it to make our determination of probable cause, right? It helps us to, in addition to the field sobriety test, the standard field sobriety test, the PBT out there gives us some information that we use to help that, but it's not sufficient reliability to be admitted as evidence. What about criminal history? Can we use criminal history to, help out with some of our determination for probable cause out there? Yeah, definitely, right? Now, there's things that, come with it though. The seriousness of the offense, the recency of it, Amanda, duh, right? The recency of the offense here. Somebody committed a crime 20 years ago, that's not going to carry much weight, but we can help that to make a determination. There's some statutes when it comes to determining domestic violence arrests, you've got to rely on criminal history or DUI things. So we got to put that in our there. But the criminal history report's not always going to be admissible under the rules of evidence. So out of Minnesota, a person's criminal record is among the circumstances when a judge may consider when determining that probable cause exists. So we can use that to make that determination, but sometimes it's not coming in as evidence. Miranda, that's something else that we use out there when trying to gather evidence. And if we don't read somebody Miranda when they're in arrest-like custody, known officer, and we're asking them incriminating questions, well, we know that there's going to be issues, especially if they confess to that. And we don't read them their Miranda rights. We know that testimonial evidence is not going to be used in court, but we can use those statements, even if it's a violation, to help us make a probable cause determination. So, as this case said, statements taken in violation of Miranda may not be used to prove the prosecution's case at trial. Okay, those statements we can't use, but such evidence may be used for other purposes to help establish probable cause, and if it satisfies legal standards of trustworthiness. Well, no matter what, it still can't be coerced, right? And that's the whole basis of Miranda is, a coercive police environment and taking that away. So we've got issues with it if it's a coerced statement, no matter what. So a Miranda violation will not cause an otherwise voluntary statement to be excluded from a probable cause analysis. We're going to use that statement as a probable cause analysis, but later on, when the rules of evidence come in, we won't be able to use that testimonial statement because we violated their Miranda. Hearsay, right? The old game of telephone. We use a lot of hearsay to develop probable cause. We get victim statements. We get witness statements out there. People tell us a ton of information on scene that helps us to make that probable cause determination. And we use that, but as we know, it's a out of court statement, this hearsay. I can't attest to what the witness said in court, but we can use that to make our probable cause determination. So in this, the petitioner contend that the information given by the informer was hearsay. And because hearsay is not legally competent evidence in a criminal trial, could not legally have been considered for purposes of probable cause. we find that petitioner entirely in error. It says we can use that information as hearsay. We'll talk about informants here in just a second. But hearsay evidence can and oftentimes does make up a part or even all of the reasonable suspicion of probable cause forming. Okay, that's a lot of how we gather information out there. Victims, witnesses, people telling us stuff that they saw or what happened to them. We use that all the time. So, as with any other type of evidence considered in reasonable suspicion of probable cause, it's got to be reasonably reliable. Okay, we don't want the person that maybe has some credibility issues or mental health issues, given, we want it to be based on foundationally reasonably reliable. And when we look at this, how are we going to make this determination if stuff is going to be this hearsay information is to be reliable? Well, how credible is our source? How trustworthy is our source of information? Who's telling us this information? And we'll talk about these a few different sources of information of hearsay in just a second. But what are we going to be able to say as to why we believe them? And how do they know what they know? Did they see it firsthand, or did they hear it from a friend who heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend who? All right, little REO speedwagon from you. So, how do they know that? Okay, where do they get this information for you? Let's look at these two folks here. All right, if we see the nun here on the left, and it's not from last Thursday, it's not Halloween night, but we see her and she says, "You know what, I've got some information to give you, officer, and here's what's going on." Should we trust her? Is there a baseline of trustworthiness that should come from her? And the answer is yes. Versus the guy next to her here. Who knows who he is? Anybody remember him or what he does? Or did? There you go, news. Yep. Brian Williams, right? Brian Williams was the anchor of the NBC News at night. And well, Paul, yes, but that's the whole point of what we're going to talk about here. So Brian Williams said he went over to Afghanistan and he gave this whole report that, he was riding along with these army guys here, and they took on an attack, and they were shot at and blown up, and all kinds of just harrowing type things that were going on here. And he said, "This is what happened to me." Well, come to find out, they talked to some of the soldiers that were over there, and they're like, "Well, he was here, but none of that happened, right? None of the getting shot at or getting blown up or any of that kind of stuff, right?" Marvin says, "Don't trust the media," right? And so now he became himself, he became what? A proven liar, right? He lied. And he got demoted from the anchor desk. They sent him, I think, to MSNBC for a while or whatever it was. But his credibility was shot. Could we, if he wanted to give us information and we know that he's a proven liar, are we going to take that for granted? No. We know that's not going to be the case. So we've got to put some of that in there. And then if our informant's credibility is either questionable and it cannot be ascertained, sometimes we talk about totally anonymous information, then we've got to go to this third piece of the pie here. How reliable is the information being provided on this particular occasion? It's not a generalized statement, but what are we talking about right now, and how do you know it? You gotta vet that. You gotta corroborate that story a little more, because especially if their credibility is in question. So some factors that go towards reliability. Have we done anything to corroborate this information? And that's important. When we get information and doing so to help us to determine that probable cause, this information we got from us, did what we do? Did we vet this? I would a lot of times get information from informants when I was worked with the DEA task force for a while, and they'd say, "Hey, so and so is meeting so and so at this corner at 7 o'clock at night." I might go out there and do a little surveillance and watch the meet happen. I wouldn't take action on it, but that would help me to corroborate my informant's reliability. They knew this was going to take place. I'd see it go down, and I would document that on a officer's report, and use that to show that information has been corroborated. Have they made statements against his penal interest? If they're telling you their involvement in a crime, Well, you know what? We could probably believe that they are telling us the truth to a certain degree. That they're saying, "Hey, I was involved in this burglary, but I want to give you some information about what was going on there." That helps us to show that reliability. And we talk about their basis of knowledge. You know, how do they know what they know? Where did they get this information from? Was it firsthand? They saw it took place, or like I said, they were a part of the crime. Okay, that helps to it. But the, you know, the further detached they get from it, then, you know, there's a little less reliability. So we'll jump into the credibility of our sources a little bit here. Should we be able to trust other officers when they give us information about something? Is that a good source of information, other cops that we work with? Look at that. Yes, is all around. I'm glad to hear that, right? Yes. Okay. There's no reason we shouldn't trust each other in what we're doing. If you tell me something, yeah, there you go, right? Zach says, unless there's a clear reason not to. Of course, you know, hey, you know, I found the gun over there in the bushes. You know, here's what information there. Okay, well, you know, we're going to use that. Doug, I'm with you on that, right? If he was whispering in my ear like that, I would have questions, right? That's a little too close for comfort, right? On that one, for sure. for sure, right? Hey, dude, little personal space here, huh? Back up. You can tell me from a distance. I don't need you creeping up on me, right? All right, again, for sure. We can trust that. There it is. One more time for you. All right. What about our citizen informers? These are people that are, you know, not involved. They're not looking to either get out of a charge. They are not trying to work, you know, work for money. They are known that, so it's not anonymous. Should we be able to believe or trust that information they're giving us to a certain degree? Yeah, good citizens, yes. Yes. Again, yeah, again. Aaron says nosy Nancys have limited credibility. Yeah, get off my lawn, right? Get out of here. For sure, right? You know, but we gotta, you know, at least to some degree of certainty, you know, why. And, you know, a citizen informant is someone who volunteers information. They don't want anything in return. For the information is not at risk or in fear of going to jail. You know, every person that gets hung up with a teener of coke in their a pocket can give you the world, right? I can get you pounds right now. All right, they're not they're going to jail. But yeah, Marvin says that's a Karen, right? For sure. But you know, they don't want anything in return. So there's a degree of reliability when it comes to that, even in the eyes of the courts. A citizen informer is presumed to be speak honestly and accurately when we're doing so. You know, the criminal snitch who's making a you know, this for that trade enjoys no such presumption, right? So again, what happens to snitches out there, everybody? What do they get? There it is, right? Stitches, hugs. Get stitched up in ditches, a plea, probation. Dang, end up in ditches. Yeah, there you go, right? So that they're looking for something. So again, our citizens informers are presumed to speak honestly and accurately, unless the officer or should be aware of information that casts doubt on the credibility of that. You know, let's say you know, somebody calls up and says, "Hey, my ex-girlfriend is over there selling dope on the corner. She should probably be arrested." Does that doubt cast doubt on their reliability? Heck yeah, it does, right? So generally, that information from our citizen informers that again don't have some doubt doesn't need to be corroborated as much as when we talk about our confidential informants. So you see, you know, the gray hair I got. Gray hairs, I got what's going on right here. A lot of that is from working confidential informants for quite a few years in my career. Oh my goodness. All right, good times for them. You know, they're a necessary evil for sure. But, you know, when we talk about these confidential informants, you know, we've got to establish some sort of a reliability or a track record. And I know it sounds kind of like an oxymoron, a reliable informant, right? But you know, that's kind of how we have to do business in a lot of the things that we do as cops out there is establishing some kind of credibility so that the information that they give us, we can show and use in our stuff here. So in this McRae case here, they'd use this informant 15, 16 times, and it'd proven to be accurate. And they'd shown that they'd given information, led to a search warrant, narcotics found, guns found, whatever it was, and that showed a track record of what was going on, and using that information helped us to determine probable cause. So how are we going to establish this track record? Convictions are good, especially when they gave us the information and it led to a conviction. Arrests are good too, but convictions are better. Did we actually discover contraband or evidence based on the information they gave? Verification of predicted criminal activity. Did they give you information that only they would know about from being involved, and it was something that was a future activity. We'll talk about that in a couple of cases here. It was predictive of future actions taking place, and that's a pretty big deal, because you'd have to have some inside information to be able to give that type of stuff up there. And then hopefully you guys are, if you're using these informants, document in some way, shape, or form all this stuff. Informant so and so gave me information, it led to this, it led to the search warrant. Keep that, so then you can show their track work record, and then you can attest to their reliability in doing so. But we talk about some of our informants out there. Do we want our informants being the poster child of our case in the courtroom? Nope, right? Nope, for sure. All right, so there's something called the informer's privilege that comes with this, and we look at this, all the most all states out there have this. I've seen a couple states where they're maybe looking at this a little bit to try to pull this off the books a little bit here, but it's a common law thing that's been around forever, and essentially it's the informer's privilege, but it's really the government's privilege to keep its sources of information confidential. I worked a ton of informants in my career, and not once did I ever have them testify in court. It was my goal, as quickly and as swiftly as I could, to basically get them out of the way and then move the case forward on things. And there's that privilege to protect them. And kind of the why behind that here is, it's a vital part of law enforcement. Okay, it's a how we do business. It's how we gather information about murders or burglaries or drugs or guns, whatever it may be. But the basic rule in this is protecting their identity upon that belief. And if we're not protecting that identity, there's no way we're going to encourage people to provide information about law enforcement. If it's like, hey, you're getting thrown on the stand constantly for giving up information. I think you guys said, yeah, well, that the snitches get stitches and end up in ditches, right? As somebody said earlier on here, there's no encouragement in that. We want to protect the informer and their family from a potential harm. Testifying or giving information against a person could open themselves up for harm. And preclude adverse social reactions. Hey, oh yeah, that guy snitched on me. He's no good. And then malicious prosecution claims against the informant. Those are all things as to why we have this protection out there in our informants out there. So in this McRae case here, it talks about how the informer's privilege and the disclosure of the identity. The argument that came up in this is like, the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, and that, the right to, confront your accusers under the Sixth Amendment. And basically they said, hey, they said that this wasn't a violation. So we find no support for those petitioners' position in either of those constitutional provisions. They said that wasn't an issue in protecting the identity of this person. So, but a lot of this is, in our preliminary hearings, the prosecution is not constitutionally required to disclose information that could lead to the identification of the informant unless there's compelling defense interest in doing so. The defense could raise a question of prejudice to saying, hey, I can't, I can't defend my client without, knowing this information that was provided, or knowing, the credibility of this person here. And, the judge can take a look at that and, have a chambers meeting and say, okay, hey, who's your informant? What's going on? Without completely exposing them out there in doing so. So there may be compelling interest at times if your informant is a, direct part of the evidence. That changes the story a little bit. as far as your elements determination. That may change things, but for the most part, we do not have to disclose our confidential informants in that. When we talk about anonymous tipsters or anonymous informants, the game changes a little bit more in that one because, we don't know who they are. And it's tougher this day and age to be truly anonymous, with phones and everything, but it could still happen out there. And this Illinois versus Gates case, was anonymous. The tipster or the anonymous information came in by letter and said, "Hey, the Gates are involved in selling narcotics out of their house," and they gave a bunch of information about travel plans, future travel plans, and they're gonna fly here to Florida and then drive back. And the cops did do a bit of corroboration to determine the probable cause to search their home in this, but it was based on this anonymous information that was coming in, and it's the predictor of future events was a big part of this when they looked at the Gates case. And then this Alabama versus White case is more of a reasonable suspicion type case, but the two kind of compare in a sense here, where the information that came in also was a predictor of future events. They said that, White was staying at this particular hotel in this particular room. She drove this vehicle, this type of vehicle, and she'd be leaving about this time, and she'd be going to this Dobie's motel. And all these factors that, the cops set some surveillance up. They saw her leave, and there she was heading towards the Dobie's motel. And they made the stop. Of course, they get narcotics out of it. And they said, okay, well, this was a close one when we look at this, but we conclude under the totality of circumstances, the anonymous tip in this, hey, she's going to leave the hotel, she's going to be driving this, she had a briefcase, and she's been going to this particular place. Well, this exhibited sufficient indicata of reliability to justify the investigatory stop. They said that, hey, you know what? There is reasonable suspicion to do so. But they also said it's important was the caller's ability to predict the future behavior. That shows that they have inside information in this. It demonstrated that inside information, specific familiarity of her car or her affairs. The general public wouldn't know that she was going to be leaving the building to get in the same car and drive to the most direct route to that Dobie's motel. This is all the factors that they looked at in determining that reasonable suspicion exists. Take a look at those two cases, the Gates and the White case. It's interesting because it really throws in those factors of the information being provided to us. All right, I've been yammering for quite a while. Sorry about the peeps. I was trying to talk quick. Did you guys find this information useful? I hope so. That's what we're here for at Blue to Gold. We really, 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 we love doing these. I hope you guys really appreciate it.